Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack. Welcome to Top Shelf at Merrick Library. I am your host, Carol Ann Tack, and today's episode features an incredible debut, and I do mean incredible. The debut is Agatha of Little Neon by today's guest, Claire Luchetti. Agatha of Little Neon has been called blazingly original by author Christina Henriquez. O Magazine calls it a literary version of Sister Act by way of Wes Anderson, and Scott Simon of NPR calls it a wry, insightful, and remarkable debut novel. And these early reviews, they just go on and on. Claire Luchetti's work has appeared in Granta, Kenyon Review, Plowshares, Oh, the Oprah Magazine, Smithsonian Magazine, and if you haven't read her short stories, you simply must. But I'm going to stop there and give a very warm welcome to Claire Luchetti. Thank you so very much for joining me and the Merrick Library patrons today and all of our listeners. I'm thrilled that you're here.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a real honor.
I finished Agatha of Little Neon in 2 days. And then I went back to find all of the things that I missed the first time, if that's even possible. But honestly, and I am being honest when I say I went back to get the feelings that the book just evoked in me. It's about life and love and the things we know about ourselves, but also the things we've always believed about ourselves that may not necessarily be true. And then finding these unlikely people in your life who help you through. It is such a beautiful book. If you would, please tell listeners about the amazing Agatha of Little Neon.
Wow. I feel like you're probably the better woman for the job. So Agatha of Little Neon follows a group of four religious sisters who at the beginning of the book find out that their diocese has run out of money and are made to move to Woonsocket, Rhode Island, where they head up a halfway house and live with people who are in recovery from addiction and people who are on parole. And the book is narrated by Agatha, who I consider the eyes of this group of nuns. She sees everything and records everything and has an opinion about everything, but doesn't always say it out loud.
What I love about Agatha of Little Neon is that we start with this cocoon environment of the convent, and the sisters are caring for each other. They're also caring for these little babies that they're responsible for, these little kids. And now they are thrust into this much wider environment. And I mean, they have all kinds of growing up to do when this happens because of this situation that boots them out of the church and their convent. And as Agatha moves about in the world, her feelings change. The way she sees things, how she processes all of it. And as a reader, you put me right there with her as she comes of age, in a sense. When did Agatha come to you as a character, her voice and her life?
Actually, at first, it was the group of nuns that presented itself to me. In the beginning, I was writing in the first person plural and narrating from this group perspective. And it wasn't until much later in the process that I started to individuate members of the group. In the beginning, it seemed like maybe there were 18 nuns in this group, maybe 300, but four ultimately was much more manageable. And Agatha, because she is the eyes for this group, presented herself as a natural narrator, because who else could tell us everything about this time in their lives and who else could speak for the group?
There's so many things about this book, and the readers will come to it. I'm not going to spoil. There aren't really spoilers, but I'm not going to reveal too much because I want readers, listeners, and patrons to come to the book the way I did, because it was such an experience, very visual for me. There's a scene where the sisters are actually getting ready to leave and they're packing things up, but they make a reference to that everything was different colored as a fact of their leaving. So it made me think of like the first day you're getting ready to go on vacation or you're taking a road trip and suddenly the trees are green or the sky is more blue. The music on the radio is just the perfect, song at that time. When Agatha sort of mentions that, I felt that. I understood what she was saying there. So when you say she's the eyes of the crew, I absolutely get that as a fan and as a reader. I want to just briefly mention New Bees. It's one of your short stories, and that short story appeared in Plowshares, and then it was featured in the Pushcart Prize anthology. I think it was 44, Best of the Small Presses of 2020. How do you get from New Bees to Agatha of Little Neon? Was that what started it for you, or like how did that work?
Yeah, New Bees has always been the kind of axis around which the book spun. It's one of the things that has stayed in from each draft, has kind of not changed or been changed slightly enough that the heart of the story is still easily identified in the book. It was important for me in writing New Bees to kind of illustrate this like huge central tension between priests and nuns, and the fact that nuns are never going to have the opportunities that priests have. And that is something that I tried to stretch out and examine further in the book length narrative. What does it mean to devote yourself to an institution that is never going to see your contributions and your service as important or as worthy as that of a man's?
So when you do write New Bees, at what point did you say there's something more here? There's something more that I can do with this story?
Yeah, at the time I was actually working on my graduate school thesis, which was a totally different process. Luckily enough, while I was working on that, I started to get, you know, encouraging feedback from the world. You know, it was accepted for publication. I used it as samples for fellowships. And that little bit of feedback goes a long way in fueling the work. So having people give it a nod of approval was the validation and the encouragement that I needed to keep going.
Well, drinks for all of those people. On me if you're ever in New York. And now it's on the podcast, so I have to stick to it. Like you mentioned earlier, Agatha notes that her and her fellow sisters are like parts of some strange asymmetrical body. Agatha is the eyes of the group. The idea of each one of her sisters having a physical attribute of their larger whole. I don't even know how you're able to do that and how you thought of that.
Yeah, I'm always really attentive to group dynamics, and I pay close attention to the role that I play in certain groups and the roles that, you know, people I know and love play in certain groups. I've never really been the go-getter of any one friend circle. I've never been the one that organizes and does logistics. So that seemed like an important person to have, but I've also never been like the quiet, reclusive, mysterious one. So for that reason, Agatha, because she was so different from me, presented herself as, you know, a really attractive narrator. I think I was thinking about the language that the church uses to refer to the body of the church. You know, I was thinking about what it means for a group of people to act as one body. And then that seemed to naturally extend itself to the kind of metaphor there.
The book gives voice to everyday life things, family, sexuality, addiction, aging, the Catholic Church, sexual abuse scandal, all of these things Agatha is facing. I want to say she's facing them for the first time because she and her fellow sisters are now in Woonsocket. And like I said, the world opens up quite a bit for them, especially Agatha's. You balance the humor with the darkness of life. And that's just what life is. But everything about Agatha is real to me. She's genuine. She's relatable. And if you haven't guessed, it was a very emotional read for me. And I'm not sure it's because I spent a lot of my years in Catholic school, but it certainly, a lot of it resonated with me. Did you attend Catholic school, or what's your experience with that?
I did. I went to a Catholic high school. And I was raised Catholic, you know, baptized, had a first communion, was confirmed in the eighth grade. And I have a lot of really tender memories about my Catholic upbringing, mostly because I can see the ways in which I, you know, shrunk myself to fit into this role of Catholic girl. I mean, I had a really rich experience at Catholic high school. I met so many wonderful people. The school was Jesuit, and, you know, I still really admire so much of Jesuit doctrine. But ultimately, in leaving the high school, my faith just kind of dried up really quickly. Once I no longer had to, you know, show up in these settings, I found that I didn't have enough left to transfer itself independently to consider, you know, my own religious practice.
I went to Bishop Ford High School in Brooklyn, Central Catholic High School in Brooklyn. And I was the first class of girls they allowed into this old boys'
school. Wow.
It's just like, talk about leaving my grammar school and then going into this like high school. It was just, I still have, as you said, very fond memories of my high school experience. I do want to ask, Woonsocket, Rhode Island, plays as much a character in the book as anything else. Tell me about setting it in that location.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in New England, both in college and after college. And Woonsocket, to me, represented a place where the nuns' ideals and faith and vision of justice and fairness and love would be tested in real time. It's a community that is struggling with poverty. It's a community that struggles with addiction. And by specifically choosing the halfway house as a setting, the nuns would have no choice but have to grapple with these issues of, you know, seeing people suffer for reasons that they don't really have control over. But it was important to me to see what it means for Agatha and her sisters to work and serve either judgmentally or non-judgmentally and see which of those characters would act which ways.
Very interesting, especially the dynamic of all of the other characters. I'm thinking of specifically of the sisters sitting down when they're having dinner and they're meeting Lawnmower Jill or Tim Gary and all of those other characters. Lawnmower Jill really still stays with me. I still think of her like she's just one of those characters for me. I also think about Mother Roberta. Mother Roberta, for me, is such a powerful character. There's a line that everything we knew about living, we knew because Mother Roberta had showed us. And I kept thinking of Peggy Wood as the role of Mother Roberta. And I'd be curious if anybody else says that later on down the road. She's the Reverend Mother in The Sound of Music. She sings Climb Every Mountain. But anyway, that's who I kept thinking of. And there's a scene at the beginning of the book where Agatha is reminiscing about this version of their younger selves or when they were still in the convent. And it just brought tears to my eyes. And it's when they're sort of coming down this hill and they see Mother Roberta at the kitchen window and she's so happy to see them. And I mean, that is just such a beautiful scene. And I know writers are supposed to do that, but how did you write that scene? Like, what was in your mind when you were, it's very visual.
Right. Yeah. I think I went back in my head to times in my life where I was overcome with joy and love and feeling really cherished, mostly by other women in my life, people who have served as mothers, my own mother, the kind of overwhelming love that a mother can show to her kids is something that is so special and irreplaceable. And so I wanted Mother Roberta to serve that kind of role for Agatha and for the other sisters.
And she did it for me.
I know, same.
So was she based on anyone or was she sort of just this idea, like a sort of a microcosm of other sisters that you had grown up with or seen in high school?
Yeah, I would say she's more of a microcosm. In researching this book, talked to a number of different women religious from different ages. And it was important for me to think about the ways that the younger nuns who have inherited this church would interact with older generations who have handed it down to them, and the ways in which their devotion and their anger and their compassion would be different across the generational lines.
Yeah, it's really something. She She really evoked a lot of emotion from me, and she was a beautiful character. And I'm not going to say anything more about that because I want readers to get there with her on their own. And there are so many astute observations, and they're so beautifully given to us. I almost don't have the words to describe it, but there's also other things that you bring in, like the relationships you mentioned earlier between the men and the women in the book. There's a couple of very interesting scenes, and you just portray them so beautifully, these relationships. And when Agatha sort of gets her eyes opened, she's coming to the realization and we're getting it at the same time. And that is just really a phenomenal thing that you have done for us. So I'm saying thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I was thinking so much when I started writing, it was the summer of 2016, and I was thinking about different kinds of power. And, you know, Trump was running and there was so much rage in me. And I thought that, you know, the Catholic Church was like the perfect representation of those power dynamics, but made literal and made unavoidable because of whatever doctrine they cling to.
Yeah, this is a wonderful interview. I am so happy that you're here. Your book comes out on Tuesday, which is tomorrow. But by the time this podcast launches, tomorrow will have come and gone for you. Your book tour will be in full swing. One of your first interviews is with Christina Enriquez, and her book, The Book of Unknown Americans. It is really a terrific, terrific story. But so you are going to have the sit down with her. I will be a fan. You're welcome. Thank you. Where can listeners find you on social media if they want to catch up with a lot of these events?
Yes, I would love to see people at these events, you know, on my screen and from a safe distance away. Yeah. People can find event information at www.clairelucchetti.com. So clairelucchetti.com. And I also am deeply devoted to my Instagram, which is just my first and last name again.
Okay. That's great. So this is, I mean, I almost want to say on your mark, get set.
Oh, yes. Today is like the eve of, you know, so much activity. I on Saturday tested positive for COVID.
Oh my goodness.
I know.
I'm so sorry.
It's been a frantic few days, but then this morning I tested negative. So it's like a little Agatha miracle.
I almost went there. You took it. You took it before I could even say it. Exactly. We will take it. That's amazing. Well, I am very glad to hear that. I'm sure our listeners are glad to hear that. Any book recommendations you'd like to share to listeners before I let you go?
Yeah, absolutely. Alex Kleeman's Something New Under the Sun is going to shake the waters. It comes out tomorrow as well. And Anthony Biasnasso's After Parties also is sure to be much discussed.
Okay. Both of those titles will appear on the podcast page for this episode. Today's book, Agatha of Little Neon, by today's guest, Claire Lucchetti, is available now. So please grab a copy at your local library or your local independent bookstore. Agatha of Little Neon is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, which is a division of Macmillan Publishers. Listeners, thank you for joining us today. Claire Lucchetti, I don't have enough thanks to say to you for being here.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for reading so closely and so generously.
You made it very easy. We'll say that. Okay, listeners, thank you all, Merrick patrons. Thank you, as always, for your support. Thank you all for joining us today. Remember to follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you find most podcasts. For the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library, check out our website, merricklibrary.org. Special thanks, as always, to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmier and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and on to the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.